And you're listening to 87.9 Crow Voices. Today we're going to take a look at the Crow Water Compact, the Water Settlement Act. What are the implications of the various treaties that have been ratified in this area? Colonialism. What are senior water rights? Allocation calculations. PIA, practical irrigatable acres, allottees, and the historic understanding of allottees, land, water, cost evaluations and calculations, compensation, and the loss of the ability to sue when just compensation has not been achieved. The Eloise Cabell case and the implications of the historic role of the BIA in its trust obligations. What are Section 2 violations? The McCarran Act. All of those issues and more will be coming up in just a few moments, live here at Centerpole Crow Nation. Stay tuned.
Crow Voices, 87.9 at Well Known Buffalo. Inawabe. Uwa Shilish. Elamiak. Digi Kahala.
Iwut Shila. Yatta. Ah, itchiginawabesh. Balewat Shilak. Hiden Bajela boom. Balewaji mehawa de lauk. Amani o shittak. Awegyoda. Absalo ge. Dela hien ashihal kukala kukshivio kirin hie majeom hem. Hinawabesh bolech bak hilelu kem ittuk. Ittak koregiwaka hem. Hinagena introduce kot bahak. Ichiga manio hem. Hina na na wajewa de la she. Thomas Lubin. Hem achbe la she gyo Mike Gross. Dupta go kem. Hinagena bale wajewio ka. Balewai chena allottees gada rights aus koi balewaj rewe okem itta kodak newa besh balewaj chilak hinna hilage. This is Tom Lubin. Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself? And
thank you very much, Beverly. I am a partner in the law firm of Lubin, Johnson & Barnhouse in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I've been practicing federal Indian law for 40 years. I've worked for several Native American rights organizations, including the Native American Legal Defense and Education Fund and the National Indian Youth Council. My undergraduate degree is in geophysical engineering, a combination of geology and geophysics, which has led me into water rights practice and pretty much anything associated with land. I have litigated several Indian water rights cases, including United States v. Tucson and Alvarez v. Tucson, which was a situation wherein individual Indian allottees' water rights were extinguished in favor of tribal rights, somewhat similar to what I think is happening here on the Crow Reservation.
And his partner here, Mike Gross, you want to go ahead and introduce yourself? And
certainly. Thanks, Beverly. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I am a year older than Tom Lubin, and we're both in our late 60s. I graduated from Brown University in the class of 64, and I went to Yale Law School, and after that, I took a job, I thought, for a two-year stint, kind of a Peace Corps experience, in Window Rock, Arizona, working for a new legal services program under President Johnson's War on Poverty. It was called Dineme Ina Nahilan Be'ad Ahi Incorporated, which was a Navajo name meaning attorneys who work for the economic but revitalization of the people. And my two-year stint has turned into a 43-year long stint and it's still going. I'm still working on my first case. That's almost literally true. First day I got there, I was assigned to an Indian school closing situation for a remote Navajo community, and after an unsuccessful lawsuit, helped the community start the first Indian-controlled school since the Cherokee schools were closed down by force in the late 19th century in Oklahoma. And it made national news, helped bring about the Indian Self-Determination message by President Nixon and then the Indian Self-Determination Act in 1975. In the meantime, I helped start a coalition of Indian-controlled school boards in which at least two Crow people who became good friends of mine who have since deceased participated actively, Wanda Medicine Horse and Sylvester Nose's Gun, and I still remember them very fondly. The coalition really was a powerhouse in Indian education reform for 10 years. I am new to Indian water rights in the sense, not exactly new, but my practice has been largely in the Indian self-determination contracting and rights area. I've litigated in the Supreme Court successfully, and we have an ongoing class action in which the Crow Nation, I believe, is a class member. That's still pending, but we've recovered so far about $113 million that we passed out to Indian tribes around the country for underpayments of certain funds that are due to all contractors under this act but weren't paid by the U.S. government yet. One final claim is still pending, and we're waiting a decision on that from the appellate court in Denver any day now. So I got invited to this water party out of the blue by a foundation in New York City that I was friends of for some years, the director of. And she told me about this situation here and asked whether I might be able to find a lawyer who could help Alatis vindicate their rights. Well, I finally stumbled on Tom Lubin, which surprised even me because I should have known about Tom Lubin all this while anyway, and sort of in the back of my mind didn't come to the front of my mind. But when I did, I immediately contacted him, and he told me that he'd been involved here at Crow for some time and knew all the folks and was planning to have a meeting with them, which took place yesterday, and I offered to come to sit in as an observer. And that's what happened yesterday, April 16th. And here we are talking about that meeting, I think, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mike. I want to say this in Crow, and then I'll say it in English. September 22nd, 2008, Kurdish, they had a hearing, and the hearing, in one of the statements that was made, was that the Crow Reservation supplies the most water for the state of Montana. Chirashikyal ewag apsalogin. Na bashpiluash batchajik. Bashpilua on na reservation maush basawash bila a supply a bile a kashish kalhele a kashish kyok him balealach the giwak had nawabesh ewakulagichi magic him hirage so we understand today we've been told and we've been informed that the Crow Reservation supplies most of the water for the state of Montana. And when I first heard that, I was shocked. Hey, Minawa Bay, Bashpiluash were in jeopardy. Hey, Mina, Hilagena. Tom, what are you aware of the what's going on with the water today on the Crow Reservation? And then I'm going to ask the same question to Mike.
Beverly, that's a big question. it's a very large issue. It's a very complex issue. I have reviewed the 1999 Crow Compact. I've reviewed the 2010 Crow Tribe Water Rights Settlement. I am familiar with federal policy dealing with Alati water rights and tribal water rights. And I am also aware of case law, past court decisions that deal with Indian Winters Doctrine water rights, tribal water rights, and individual Alati water rights. I would not say that I am thoroughly knowledgeable about the situation on the Crow Reservation because it is so complex and it does have such a lengthy history behind it. I have, however, reached some conclusions about some of the things that seem to be happening on the reservation.
Thank you. Mike?
Oh, boy. I'm even more in the dark than Tom in a certain sense, but I've been involved in organizing and helping individual tribal members in various locations organize themselves to vindicate their rights, particularly in the field of Indian education. And I can tell you that from what I hear about the water situation, which I learned primarily from Tom on in several meetings and the plane ride from New Mexico, every time I talk to him, I am more and more impressed with his knowledge and his very objective way of looking at issues like this. What I can say is there are two aspects of anybody's rights and how to vindicate them in our American legal system. The two broad categories are the substance of what your right is, in this case, water rights. And then there's the procedural aspects of vindicating those rights, like which court do you go to, or do you go to court, or do you try to go to Congress and lobby for changes in law, or do you use political means and things like that. And in my experience, all three are useful, but have to be used very wisely and at the right time and in the right manner. And every one of those approaches, excuse me, whether it's political or congressional or litigation or organizing in local sense, it involves risks. And if you want to preserve your rights and extend them and get them recognized, whatever the field, the first need is to inform yourself. If you rely on other people telling you what the facts are and you don't double-check them for yourself, and if you rely on other people who say, don't worry about it, we're going to take care of you, and you know, whether it's the trustee, namely the big father in Washington, D.C., or local people or elected officials, whether they're state or municipal or tribal, and you don't check it out for yourself, you run a risk. And I observed the meeting yesterday, and I read up on it, and I talked with Tom, and I talked with you and another Crow people that I met here, and I've come to the conclusion that there's a great need for everyone who is an Alati to learn what this is all about for himself or herself. And the best way to do that is to stay in touch with the newspapers, this radio station. At the end of this broadcast, some telephone numbers are going to be given to you, and make use of them and get involved. And that's the big message. I, for my part, was asked to see if we can round up some funds to help pay for an effort to get a voice at the table of what's going on, the details of which I hope Tom will explain to you in a few minutes. if you don't have a seat at the table and you rely on other people to who say, don't worry about it, we're going to take care of you, you can assume the opposite is true. And while nobody can, I mean, whether hundreds and I understand there are 6,000 allottees here, cannot sit at a table all at the same time, you can get involved with each other. You can organize each other with each other. You can elect spokespeople who can then report back to you. That's how our system works. It works in Congress. It works in the local municipal government sense. It works in tribal politics. It works everywhere. And it works in the courts. And that's how you get things done. And that's how you get satisfaction, if it's possible, for your rights. You stand up for them. You inform yourself. And that's the message I would bring to you, the Crow people, from what I've seen. You have a beautiful reservation. I've been here in Montana many times. I worked with the Northern Cheyenne years ago. And I always passed by and never really saw anything at Crow. And I did just today, this morning, and this afternoon. And I'm just completely blown away. This is a beautiful, beautiful treasure you have. And to see its pristine beauty and to think what might happen if corporate interests take over your water rights and take all the coal out and pay you pennies for it, it breaks my heart.
Kachi wi lu kala balami kina balagu biwaya machije ochig balashtu basa bag bagon ashe wiek bima pagawa kuidu bagaria kashit especially crow fair kodet bagon ashe gishpaku kamagaria kashikem ikkadalag pashichisuk yagena amalagot pish na basho dua malagot pish nawabe agusesh basho chi sowabe agusesh shot by wa nabile a neche vios ba bawadat sagma a malagusesh a hoke minawabe bawashichi gasa olagi chi much when I was a child, I remember a bunch of us kids would go swimming. And we didn't have a second thought about whether we could or not. But that's going to make a difference. Tom, can you comment on that?
I've had a great good time in swimming holes myself, but. I do have a few words to say about what I see happening here. I want to just give a very brief sketch of the Winter's Doctrine of Federal Indian Reserve Water Rights, which begin with the United States v. Winter's decision in 1908 involving the Milk River here in Montana, wherein the Supreme Court decided that when reservations were created, enough water was reserved out of the available supply to make Indian reservations useful for the purpose for which they were reserved, which is a tribal homeland. In many cases, that is primarily agricultural or was during the last century. There are, of course, other important purposes for reservations in terms of economic development. In 1887, Congress enacted the General Allotment Act, also known as the Dawes Act, and the objective was to create private property in individual Indians. The Dawes Act caused many reservations to be subdivided into allotments, and in many cases, most of the reservation was subdivided into allotments, which is the case here on the Crow Reservation. As I said, the congressional objective was to create private property. Private property is terribly important in the long tradition of what I call Anglo-American law, starting in England with the Magna Carta and various other important concepts that have been embedded in Anglo-American law and Anglo-American property law. John Locke felt that private property was the foundation of any culture. Of course, it wasn't the foundation of Native American culture, but that was the European perspective. The United States Constitution protects private property. We have the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which prohibits the federal government from taking private property unless three very important conditions are met. Those are that the individual or the people who lose their private property are provided adequate compensation for that property based on fair market values. The second is that they have due process of law, that they have the opportunity to speak up for themselves and defend themselves in a court of law. And the third is that the government can't just take private property from me to give it to you. It has to be for a public purpose, for something that's of general benefit to the culture as a whole. So that said, allottees hold water rights pertinent to their allotments as a matter of constitutionally protected property. Now, this concept with respect to allottee water rights has an interesting history. For many years, and in fact it's true to this day, many people in the federal government and many people who are knowledgeable of federal Indian law take the position that allottees do not own property in water pertinent to their allotments. The Ninth Circuit decided in Colville Tribe v. Walton very clearly that individual allotment owners do hold property rights in water pertinent to their allotments. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit and the District Court on remand in Colville Tribe v. Walton identified the specific quantity of water which is pertinent to each of the allotments that were at issue there. They quantified the water pertinent to allotments owned by the original Indian allottees or their heirs. They quantified the water pertinent to allotments that had been purchased by the tribe, and they quantified the water pertinent to allotments that had been purchased by an individual named Boyd Walton. Since that was, I think, probably the first case that addressed the existence of water rights pertinent to allotments in such detail, that conclusion has become known as the Walton Doctrine. And the federal government is quite solicitous, quite careful to acknowledge and protect what they call Walton rights, which are water rights pertinent to allotments that have passed out of trust and into fee status through the sale of the allotment by the Indian to a non-Indian. So once the allotment reaches non-Indian hands, you know that that individual has water rights for that allotment. Now, it just follows from the concept of chain of title that we all learn in law school, and that's very simple. It's if you have a piece of property, you want to know that the title is good, and the way you know the title is good is you reconstruct the chain of owners from A to B to C to D and so on. So if Mr. Walton received water rights by buying an Indian allotment, the Indian had to own water rights pertinent to that allotment. So I just don't see how anyone can deny that these rights exist. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I represented individual allottees on the Santa Vera Reservation in Arizona in a different but in some significant ways similar situation. And in that situation, there was a settlement act, the 1982 Southern Arizona Water Rights Settlement Act, that sought to recollectivize these property rights in water that were divided up among all the allottees by the General Allotment Act of 1887, because it was desired that the tribe have sole control and ownership of that water. And in that case, I'm not really sure what's happening here on the Crow Reservation, but there was a very interesting aspect of that case, and it was that because the city of Tucson had taken all the water from the Sanvir Reservation, just literally pumped it away, the settlement brought in a substitute water supply through the Central Arizona Project. And that substitute supply for the Sanvir Reservation and one other district of the Tohono O'odham Nation, that brought in 50,000 acre-feet of water for the Sanvir Reservation. And of that total of 66,000 acre-feet, 50 for Sanvir, 16,000 for the Shchukdok district, of that total of 66,000, 50,000 was expected by the city of Tucson on a 99-year lease with the Tohono O'odham Nation. And there was no provision for supplying allottees or allotments with the water that they needed to make their allotments productive, as was intended by the General Allotment Act. That situation led to the solicitor of the Department of the Interior, John Leshy, to prepare what's called a solicitor's opinion is an opinion of law by someone in a policy position, in this case the general counsel for the Interior Department. And that 1995 opinion holds that allottees on the Sanvir Reservation do have, or at that time they had, property rights in water appurtenant to their allotments. Now, I take issue with some aspects of that solicitor's opinion, but that was the really important part of it. That opinion led several years later to a policy statement from the Interior Department in the form of a memorandum from Mr. Leshy to an assistant secretary in the Interior Department. And that policy it's a three-page policy, and it's something that it would be most important for people to talk about on the Crow Reservation because it presents some very serious problems for you. It acknowledges that individuals have property rights in water appurtenant to their allotments. But then it goes on to say that it is preferable federal policy that water rights in the West be negotiated and reach negotiated settlements rather than litigating them to a judgment or a decree, as it's called in water law. And that in that process of negotiation, because there are, in some cases, and it's true here, so many allottees, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, Beverly, is that there's something like 6,000 allottees on the Crow Reservation. Because there are so many of them, it is Interior Department policy that Congress enact negotiated settlements that deal with the allottees' rights en masse, that is to say, all together. Now, the way that a water rights adjudication goes is it is ordinarily, but not always, started by a state attorney general. And often in these stream systems, and it's true here, the United States has interests in the stream system. And those might be for the National Forest, and in many cases, they are Indian water rights. The United States, in the case of the allottees, is the trustee, holds the legal title in trust for the benefit of the allottees. That includes the service and the water and the minerals. The United States, however, has sovereign immunity and can't be sued unless Congress has waived that sovereign immunity. In 1951, in a law that's called the McCarran Amendment, the United States waived its sovereign immunity to allow itself to be brought into adjudications, water rights adjudications. In the case of Montana, this is now being done in the Montana Water Court. But there's a critical condition in the McCarran Amendment, and that is that the United States sovereign immunity is only waived if it's a whole stream adjudication involving all of the water users and all of the claimants in the system. And something that's going on here that is very, very troubling to me as a lawyer advocating Indian rights and as a lawyer advocating constitutional rights and human rights, I notice that the non-Indians on the Crow Reservation who have water rights are parties to that Montana Water Court whole stream adjudication. Each of them has received notice. They've had the opportunity to object to other people's claims. In some cases, they've had objections filed to their own claims, and they are kept notified of the whole proceeding that's going on. However, in the case of the Crow allottees, the United States takes the position that it adequately represents the Crow allottees as their trustee. What does that mean? What does adequate representation mean? If you are taken into court on a DUI, you want a lawyer to represent you, and that lawyer is obligated to take direction from you in the process of defending you and to communicate with you and to discuss your case with you and how strong your case is and what evidence can be developed to support your case. Here, the United States simply says it adequately represents all the allottees, but it doesn't communicate with you. Beverly, have you heard from the United States in this water adjudication?
Not really. We haven't. We've had a meeting with the Bureau of Indian Affairs solicitors, but we have not been given this information. Ekbabema Shibua Billings on meeting Kyotiwuk with the solicitor John Chavin. Group, because they're the water commissioners. Awakpak meeting, kyo tiwuk. Information now, hinam malewajua, balejwesuk. The meeting we had with the solicitor and his group, the water commissioners, John Chavin, we were not given this information.
Well, adequate representation is not simply holding a meeting with a room full of people. It's really talking to you about your claim and about your rights in detail. And my understanding is that allotments have not been studied to determine what the practicably arable acres on each allotment is. And I didn't talk about practicably arable acres, but the Supreme Court has held that the measure of the Winter's Doctrine water right on Indian Trust land is how many practicably irrigable acres there are on that land. How many acres can you really irrigate? There's another component of that, which is called water duty. How many acre feet of water are required for each acre to grow a crop? So you multiply the water duty times the number of practicably irrigable acres to determine the total quantity of the water right on any given piece of Indian Trust land. And that requires some detailed scientific studies. including determining what the quality of the soil is, determining, again, whether an acre is practicably irrigable, determining what the water duty is. And what should be happening is that the United States should be providing the allottees with the human resources and the financial resources to do these studies on their allotments, and should be providing them with attorney representation in the form of attorneys who actually come and talk with you about what the history is of your allotment, what the history is of irrigation is on your allotment, what kind of crops you grow, and so forth, and asserting your position in the Montana Water Court. Now, just to make reference back to that policy I talked about earlier that was issued by John Leshy in 2001, he basically, if you read between the lines and you add it all up, he basically says, you know, there are a lot of Indians out there, and it's just too expensive and inconvenient for us to deal with them all. But hey, they deal with the non-Indians. Now, they don't do studies on their lands. Everyone is responsible for putting together their own case. But in this case, the trustee is obligated to provide that to the individual allottees. So, you know, I like to be careful about saying what I'm about to say, but it's very hard for me to avoid the conclusion, and I have reached the conclusion, that the way this is being handled on the Crow Reservation is profoundly racist. Non-Indians are given due process. They're given the opportunity to participate and prove their case. Indians are supposedly represented by someone in the Justice Department and someone in the Interior Department that if they ever talk to those individual allottees, it's in a big meeting where they say, well, you know, we're doing this or we're doing that, and it's all for your best interests.
Can I add a point, please?
Yes.
What Tom is touching on is what is really, in my opinion, at the root of the longstanding conflict of interest that the Department of the Interior and the United States government in general has in working to represent Indian interests as trustee and everybody else's interests as voters and citizens. And to bring it down to cases, what I've observed here seems, and of course I'm not an expert, but what I've heard sitting in discussions for about 10 hours yesterday and talking even longer with Tom and looking at some documents over the last couple of weeks, is this. There's a tribe here. It's called the Crow Indian Tribe. It has sovereign rights. It's still subject to U.S. law, and its interests are being protected by the U.S. Department of the Interior as its trustee. That's all well and good. That's how it should be. But there are Indian individuals here who also have rights, and those rights cannot be represented by the same trustee. Pure and simple. When you get in a fiduciary, as the legal term is called for the describing the trustee's duties to the beneficiary, you're talking about an elevated standard of justice, the highest form in our legal system. The trustee has to subordinate its own interests to the beneficiary, and above all else, avoid a conflict of interest. Well, here there's a built-in conflict because the U.S. government and the Department of the Interior are the trustee for both individual Indians and tribes. Yet time and time and time and time again, it seems the Department of Interior concentrates on representing tribal rights and forgetting about individual Indians' rights. They don't forget about them. I'm being a little harsh. they say, well, we are concerned about individual Indian rights and we're taking care of them, but they're not. Pure and simple is the phrase that Tom Lubin just used, I believe.
That is true.
And what needs to be done, it seems to me, is not to condemn the Crow tribe. You are all Crows. You're part of the tribe. I'm not here to condemn the tribe. I'm here to say to you, from what I've heard as an observer and new to this situation, is, my God, there are 6,000 people here who also have a trustee relationship with the U.S. government, and that trustee is basically ignoring its duty to them. You can't just go through life saying breezily, I'm taking care of you, and then do nothing, not even talk to you, as Tom pointed out. Has any one of you gotten a letter from the U.S. government saying, hey, look, there's a water adjudication going on, and here's the events, and you better quantify your water, and we'll help you do it, and you better get into this? No. No, the opposite. And when a trustee has a conflict of interest like this, admittedly, if this were a private situation entirely, the trustee should resign. That's it. You got a conflict of interest, you get out of it, because you're going to do damage to one or the other of your beneficiaries if you continue. Well, the U.S. government is in a unique position where it can't resign. So if it's going to concentrate on the tribe's rights and interests, that's fine. Then the trustee has to build a Chinese wall in the center of its building in Washington, D.C., between C and D streets, northwest, 18th and 17th streets, I think it is, and say, you can't move from this side of the building to the other side of the building and do both. This is the tribe side, that's the Indian Alatis side, and never the twain shall meet, and we'll pay for the other side, the Alatis' legal expenses and so on, so they can have their day in court. That's how you do it. You don't just muddy the waters and say, my God, we're representing all of you, and let it go at that. But it's your job to figure this out and demand your rights.
Thanks. Excuse me. My name is Patrick Hill, and the mic's not on.
Well, you're doing that. Can I make this? Is this on? Can I make this correction? The young lady that opened up the beginning of the program here made a mistake. So I wanted to correct that. My Indian name was given to me by Lizard That Walks, Hate Tosh, Dashi, Hodam Baguk Hem, Yuchi Lehuk, Hem, Ko Karekit Bamio Akuk, Aho. Pat, go ahead.
Oh, excuse me. My name is Patrick Hill. I'm an enrolled member of the Crow Tribe, and I happen to be an Alati. I've owned property since 1962, which was bought by my father through various payments that were entitled to the Crows. I, as an Alati, have owned property since 1962, but I, as my experience in being an Indian, is 56 years. I appreciate you gentlemen's background in that, your history in that, but in particular, in specifics as a Crow, I know and understand the responsibilities of the federal government to the Crow specifically, but also as a Lati, I can honestly tell you truthfully that if not one, have not received notice of those 6,000 Alatis from the federal government as to their rights on their individual property. Knowing it was their responsibility, they negated us. They denied us our right to be there at the table. One thing in particular that I've done throughout the informational forums that were held by the tribe on the compact and on the settlement is that I had the opportunity to attend each and every one of the meetings. I had opportunities to step in and stand among very limited numbers of crows at legislative hearings with, if you will, executive counsel and that of legal representative and agency representatives from the Department of Interior, the federal government. I've heard various words spoken in so much as their responsibility, yes, their obligations, yes. I've seen letters with very colorful, poetic, creative writing with letterheads from the United States government, but also in parts it was brought in those other paragraphs of those documents stating their limitations and their inabilities. I speak of that of the headings differed from that of the conclusion of the letters. I, as an Alati, feel very, very much infringed upon that of traditionally, culturally, as a Crow. And I feel strongly that everything and so much mentioned by those here that is totally the truth, that we have not, as Crows, been given our right to be at the table, which is the obligation of the federal government to specifically that of, yes, tribes, but also individual members of the Crows. I made a presentation, or was asked to speak at the legislature of the Crow tribe. I say I'm here based upon principally of that of three documents. Those documents are the Constitution of the Crow Tribe of Indians, that of the Constitution of the State of Montana, and that of the Constitution of the United States of America. I believe strongly that my rights as a United States citizen, as a citizen of Montana, and specifically that of a enrolled member of the Crow Tribe, have been violated. They have not been held, not by by that of the Crow Tribal Administration, by that of the State of Montana and their government, but by the government of the United States of America. Not only for my rights, but the rights of my people, and also the rights of, if you will, the indigenous people of this country. Everything that's been spoken here, I feel strongly, is that it's we weren't told of these things within the informational meetings. If anything, we're told superficial definitions and nothing in depth. As I've concluded and feel strongly about, these waters will clear and you'll find that more of our rights as individual Crows have been taken away. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Hilage yun dashikyaulaga opkisha. Opkisha ivise wa chargik. 40, 45, 35 to $45 per ton. I'm inserting this. Hembiruga mulutua 17 cents or 16 cents per ton. Hem ichisagiwak bale. Nabasawash opkisha wa chargik hem. Hilage nabila river kodaku baha bi waiuk hem Tom Mike, do you have anything else to say?
I wanted to talk a little bit about priorities, water rights priorities. As I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court has held that each reservation has a water right with a priority as of the date of the reservation. Now, the purpose of this is to fit reservation water rights and federal water rights into the Western states' water rights system of prior appropriation. And that system in its basic form is quite simple. The first person to come to a stream or a source of water and divert that water to a beneficial use such as agriculture establishes a priority date under state law. And if 10 people have 10 successive priority dates, and in 1 year there's a drought and the water supply isn't adequate for all of those 10 people, the people who diverted the latest lose their water first. That's the priority system. The Crow Reservation is said to have a priority of 1868. The way that I have read the Settlement Act and the Compact is that the water rights that are pertinent to the allotments, in fact, all of the Indian water rights on the reservation, are given a status which is not senior to later non-Indian rights. That is to say, the non-Indians who diverted water later than 1868 have a junior water right, but the settlement equates the Indian water rights with, I should say it a different way to make it clear. With an 1868 priority date, the holder of an Indian right could enforce that priority against a later date in a limited supply situation. In the settlement, the 1868 priority date is lost. Interestingly, non-Indians who purchased allotments in fee and who hold what the Interior Department refers to as Walton rights, they received, when they purchased their allotment, the 1868 priority date. Since they are not actually part of the settlement in terms of what the Crow Water Rights Settlement Act does, in other words, their rights are not legislated by Congress in the Crow Settlement Act, but they get the benefit of ending the 1868 priority date on tribal water. So if you're a fee owner on the Crow Reservation, a non-Indian fee owner on the Crow Reservation, you have an earlier priority date than the Indian users on the Crow Reservation. Now, I quite frankly do not know the hydrology of the Crow Reservation well enough, but I have been told that all of the stream systems on the reservation are over-appropriated. And what over-appropriated means is that more water rights have been established than there is water in the stream to serve those rights. So that in a very wet year, people with later priority dates might be entitled to water. In a very dry year, lots of people don't get water. Well, if it is true that these stream systems are over-appropriated, it seems to me that holders of Indian allotments, say on Prior Creek or say on tributaries to the Bighorn or tributaries to the Little Bighorn, in fact, I think it would even be true on the Little Bighorn, since there are non-Indian holders of 1868 priority water and the system is over-appropriated, it seems to me that they get the water before the Indians. Now, if that is not true, I'd be very interested to hear the counter-argument. And as I understand the settlement, it provides 500,000 acre-feet of natural flow out of the Bighorn. It provides 300,000 acre-feet of storage out of Bighorn Lake. But if that 500,000 acre-feet is only available in the Bighorn, that's not going to help people on Prior Creek or the Little Bighorn or tributaries to these rivers.
Thank you. Mike?
Tom's the water law expert here, and I defer to him, and I think what he said is extremely important for everybody here to understand and act upon. I take a broader view because I'm not an expert on water law as such, but I've observed Indian affairs now since 1968, and I believe a great struggle is still going on over the question of Indian identity and culture. I think the outside forces that are arrayed against the preservation of Indian cultures and land bases, on which they depend, of course, are constantly under threat. And your water rights issues here are an example of exactly that phenomenon. On the East Coast right now, there's an Indian tribe on a little island called Martha's Vineyard that's trying to do battle against a huge, giant energy project based on wind, which is going to destroy not only their scenery, looking at the ocean, which is sacred to them, but in many ways they claim will disturb the fisheries that they depend on for their livelihood. And they're trying to struggle against the forces of the outside. The European conquest of this continent is still not completed yet in that sense. If Indian tribes and cultures are to remain vibrant, these individual issues, whether it's water rights or fishing rights or the rights to your sacred mountains and your ocean views, have to be protected. And I always thought that this country was based on the idea that everybody's freedom to live the lives that they are used to, that their religions are based on, is consecrated in our constitutional system. Yet the forces outside, the economic forces that are arrayed and are very powerful against you, inevitably will win out unless the folks who are at the, you know, sitting on the ground, as it were, defend their own rights. You can't depend on the trustee, as we see, because the trustee is conflicted. Even your tribal government has interests collectively from its point of view that may contrast with your own rights. And that should be understood. That's not bad. I mean, I don't like what the city of Santa Fe does all the time. And I have a right to go to court and challenge them. I'm a taxpayer, and I can vote, and I can go to court. And I can go to meetings, and I get notices in the paper of the meetings. And if I want to go and speak out or write a letter to the editor, I can do that. But here you've got a system where the big hand of the great white father in Washington is telling you, don't worry, we're taking care of you. And I don't believe, from what I've heard, that that's true. And if this pristine, beautiful country is to be preserved and not transformed into Los Angeles, you got to do something about it for yourselves. And the only way that individuals can act, especially if they're not loaded with money, is to organize. Get together. Elect spokespeople. And that's really how I see the situation. Once you do that, it's remarkable how the system of law we have often responds positively. This isn't a hopeless cause. Everybody can win in this situation if it's handled correctly. The tribe, the allottees, the lessees, the non-Indian allottees, or derivatives of them, and even corporate forces on the outside that want your coal and your water for industrial purposes. There's a balance. There's a possibility. But you got to get on the table, get to the table, in order to vindicate those rights.
Well, that's exactly, I've seen corporations develop not in the destruction, but within the cooperative effort within those peoples that are there. But also in explaining more is that specifically as the Crow, we do have spiritual ties to the earth, and primarily that being of water. Water is used for that of Sundance, that of sweat lodges, that of peyote, even of the Christian for baptismal and also of holy water. The water is essential. It has an identity here. It has a purpose. It is a living, breathing entity. And I believe that certain aspects of this were overlooked, if looked at at all, and they need to be addressed.
We have Beatrice Rasmussen here, and she's got some comments to make. Beatrice, go ahead.
Thank you. Some years back, I was confronted by an electric corporation coming through. I'll make this as short as I can. And that electric corporation wanted my property so they could expand, add on, and service. And I refused to let them cross my property. In fact, I refused to even sign their contract. And they came to me numerous times to try to get me to sign that. Finally, they brought a charge against me of eminent domain condemnation suit on my trust property. And I said, you can't do this. And he said, well, we'll see about this. So I went to Max Baucus, the senator, and I asked him if there is anything that could be done. And he said, I'll help you any way that I can. I gave him all of the information, all of the particulars, and everything that he needed. He sent a letter to Washington, D.C., to the Attorney General, and his name was Misser. Anyway, he was an Attorney General for Montana, and he wrote me a letter, and he said they could stop it. They did stop it. He said, we do have a trusteeship obligation to protect your rights and your property. Therefore, this is over. And that was the end of it. I've never heard anything since. But I got a letter with his signature on it. And it's an official letter because I can't copy the thing.
In be cool it again is cheese him kukalagu gate bauge agena. Thank you for everybody listening, and I hope you're taking in all that you've heard today. And you know, this is an opportunity for Tom Lubin to be with us and Mike Gross to be with us, so thank you for listening today, and have a good day.
Kill. We're pursuing that of a organizing in so much as a membership, and I've offered myself as a contact. My name is Patrick J. Hill. My mailing address is Post Office Box 1151, Crow Agency, Montana 59022. Or if you happen to see me someplace, I'll be more than happy to address your wishes and desires in this pursuit for each and every one of us as crows. Thank you.
We want to give you the website for this program. It's crowvoices.wordpress.com. If you need to send your opinions and whatnot, send it to that email address. And then we also have a website, the Crow Allottees. We have a website. It's as the crow flies.net. Thank you.